Welcome to the Climb Podcast. My name is Lynn Robbins, Director of Climb, and joining me in the studio today are Drs. Roberto Montenegro and Callie Hobson. This podcast is part of Climb's Do No Harm Faculty Development series on how to make teaching more equitable and inclusive. Dr. Montenegro is an assistant professor of child and adolescent psychiatry at Seattle Children's Hospital. He specializes in cross-cultural psychiatry and mental health for the deaf and hard of hearing, and mental health for incarcerated youth. He's also the faculty theme lead for the Ecology of Health and Medicine medical student course, where he teaches on equity, diversity, disparities, and social justice in medicine. Dr. Montenegro is CLIME's Director of Bias Reduction in Curricular Content Program. We call it BRIC. He and his team comprise a multidisciplinary effort to systematically evaluate and identify potential bias in the School of Medicine's education program. Dr. Callie Hobson is a second-year fellow in child and adolescent psychiatry at Seattle Children's Hospital. She's the recipient of an American Psychiatric Association Award as a minority fellow with grant funding to support her efforts to create an anti-bias curriculum for medical students, residents, and fellows. Welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today in the studio.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you.
I love this notion that you're reviewing the curriculum systematically. Maybe you could walk us through that process.
What we do is we collect all the PowerPoints, every page of content that the medical student is given for a course. So, for example, MCBD was the most recent course that we evaluated.
And that's molecular and cellular basis of disease?
That's correct. And so we had over 3,000 pages to review. And I'm very fortunate that Dr. Hobson and I have six outstanding undergraduate pre-medical research assistants that are very dedicated and are volunteering their time to read through each page of the content. And what we do is we upload the materials onto a qualitative research software. We train the six research assistants to read through each page, and every time they find anything that's a social identifier, anything ranging from a word that denotes race, gender, sexual orientation, sexual identity, ability, immigration, political references, anything that is a social identifier, they code. And we have three different pairs of students coding the exact same material. And at the end of the week, we come together and we compare the coding schema of each of the groups. And then if there are any discrepancies, we discuss them. And then we provide one final file of the coded material. And then Dr. Hobson and I review those and look at potential bias, which the students are highlighting with code that we created for potential bias. As of now, we're basically collecting language for the computer scientists that they will use in a technique that they're going to extract this and use natural language processing.
So in the future, it'll be automated, but currently it's all done by your team.
There's two sort of parallel processes that are going on. What Dr. Montenegro just talked about is the taking out of bias from curriculum. Another parallel process that's going on is the putting in of things we think that should be included in curriculum.
The idea now is to try to come up with a way that we can use technology to automate the identification of bias so that, A, the students don't experience any type of inadvertent mistreatment or propagation of racialized medicine, and B, improve the quality of the content that the students are receiving so that they can provide better, more accurate medical care that isn't based on unfounded racialized concepts that have been propagated throughout the history of our teaching of medicine.
Maybe you could help us by giving an example of the type of bias that you might identify and how you might remedy that.
Sure. So I'll pick an example that's specific in psychiatry. And one of our biggest disorders that we treat is ADHD. and who gets treatment for ADHD and who doesn't. And there's been a lot of research that suggests that minority children who have ADHD that have similar symptoms as their white counterparts get treated less than their white peers, don't get medication as much as their white counterparts. And so it's important to learn about this stuff because it impacts the way that we practice medicine. And then further down the line, these kids get labeled as having conduct disorders and, you know, are just sort of bad kids, or their parenting's failing, or, you know, a whole bunch of other racialized things that people may put on these kids when it's really untreated ADHD.
So basically you want the connection between how the student would read the content and what is not there and what is there. They would see higher conduct disorder, for example, in African-American children. Mm-hmm. But then what Brick would do is challenge that and say, what explains that? So looking at what is the root cause of the prevalence or incidence that we're looking at. Are they talking about the bias in misdiagnosing or underdiagnosing Black children? Most likely they're not. So that's what I personally know, because I'm teaching these lectures now and I saw that they were missing what you found in the ADHD review. So I think a way of addressing this would be, for example, we reviewed the curricula content on ADHD, and we saw that there was mention of ADHD and under-diagnosing and under-treating, but the explanation was left out why. And so with Brick, we identified that race was listed and bias was listed as a risk factor, but not explained to be an artifact of different forms of racism, either interpersonal racism, institutional racism, and bias about medication treatment. So for example, there's bias that families of color or kids of color might misuse stimulants. So physicians aren't necessarily providing them with the same type of medications, which first line would be stimulants, for fear of misuse of mm-hmm. the medication. And that is based off of a physician's bias about this population and therefore leads to mistreatment or undertreatment of this medical condition.
So what I'm doing specifically for the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Fellows curriculum right now is going through all the lectures that we've been given in the last 2 years, lecture by lecture, and figuring out what, based on a structural and social determinants of health lens, what should be put into the curriculum. And I'm working also with the librarians to collect a body of literature that supports those topics or things that should be put into the curriculum. So once I identify, say, differential treatment of ADHD, I would send that over to the librarian and she would be able to figure out what literature supports that.
And then tell me, because there's got to be then another part of this where you go to a faculty member or any sort of presentation creator and you say, we've identified this bias or this gap.
The idea is that we would get back to the faculty member identifying content that might be biased, providing them with resources, like Dr. Hobson saying, that might help them address the bias, and then also providing them with content that they should take out. For example, misuse of gender terms, misuse of sex terms, misuse of race or ethnicity terms, for example, that are a little antiquated. And so we provide specific recommendations with the idea being that the faculty will hopefully take the recommendations. MCBD was a great example where a professor first did an amazing job at taking the long list of recommendations that we made. And he did take about a week to implement these changes and look through all these files and make the changes. And he was very dedicated to doing this to improve the curricula. And it was challenging. I think right now what Dr. Hobson and I are trying to focus on is using the lens of the, again, social and structural determinants of health that the Ecology of Health and Medicine is teaching the medical students so that they know how to not only critically look at the curricula content, but also critically look at the research that they're being presented, including the articles that they're being presented. So we're hopeful that this will start the beginning of shifting the way that future researchers, especially the future leaders from the UW School of Medicine, medical students, that they'll be conducting. For now, we're just simply trying to get everyone on the same page. So as you know, CLIME has been very active in teaching faculty the ecology of health and medicine components as well, and they're piloting this EHM for faculty, with the idea being that the faculty will have the same or similar knowledge base that the medical students are receiving, and that this will hopefully trickle down into how they create their content for their lectures, so that when BRIC reviews Block's content, hopefully we'll find less bias, and hopefully we'll find more addition of social and structural determinants of health.
And hopefully we'll trickle down to making different decisions medically. You know, thinking about if a Black kid shows up in my office complaining of paranoia or something, to think about, is this, you know, true psychotic paranoia, or is this due to, you know, race-based trauma and, you know, being paranoid about the police or something like that, to just sort of shape a different lens, both in research and thinking about what they're teaching, but also in clinical practice as well.
Anytime you find yourself talking about a social identifier, either in a clinical case or in a lecture, ask yourself, what is the function of that social identifier? So if you have a case that starts with a 35-year-old Latina woman presents for diabetes management checkup, you really have to figure out what is the function of all the identifiers, and is there any potential bias? Is there really a usefulness for denoting that they are Latino or Latina, or is that going to present more bias than any usefulness? Is it helpful to or necessary to include that the patient is a woman or man or female or male? And are you using the terms in a way that promotes inclusiveness and doesn't inadvertently exclude other individuals, for example, transgender individuals?
So this is really a multi-pronged process. I think about when you're doing this kind of work, that there are structures in our electronic medical record that request that kind of information. Is there pushback about not denoting race and gender? Because there's all kinds of structures that would make one question about, like, is this just political correctness? And when I get out of University of Washington School of Medicine, how am I going to function in a system that requires that I denote these things?
Excellent question. It's something that we grapple with a lot with BRIC. And again, the way that we're approaching this is pretty systematically for right now, since this is a new process. Our main lenses in terms of social identifiers is really based off of the work that Peter First and Amanda Cost have worked on a social identifiers committee and guideline that is available, I believe, in the CLIME website.
It is.
And they give very specific recommendations on how to use many of these social identifiers. And so BRIC right now is using those as guidelines. One of the trickiest ones for me and my team, I believe, has been the gender social identifiers and sex social identifiers. And we're currently working with some national leaders on this.
Working on this project has really brought a lot of humility to how I use language. When I see case presentations given to me or I receive notes from, you know, emergency departments, I'm always thinking about how is this patient being presented to me and what are the words that are being used. And realizing that the words that are being used hold so much weight. You know, there's so much when you say an African-American child, there's so many things that come up when you say that those words. And so thinking about, is it necessary to convey that they're African-American in the first line of a case presentation? Because there's so much intrinsic bias in all of us, you know, me being a person of color, there's so much, you know, bias in me and in everybody. And so really reflecting on what language we're using and how we convey what we talk about in medical literature and curriculum is really important.
But I guess what I'm really struggling to understand is I've also had physicians tell me it's all about pattern recognition. And so somebody comes in and says African-American child, I'm already like halfway down the road, and that's a good thing.
Some bias is good in, you know, especially in an emergency setting. You know, somebody comes in with chest pain, you're already like, you know, five steps down the line. These are the things that I need to order to get them treated. And that's sort of good bias in a way, because it helps them get triaged faster and helps them get treatment faster. But when it comes to race and gender and social identifiers, sometimes it cannot be so good. And people come in with pain, and we know that Black women get less pain medication than other people. And so thinking about how...
Right, because Black women tolerate pain better?
No, because we have a bias that they're strong, you know, stronger.
Okay.
And then thus can withstand more pain, but it's not true. And so some bias is good in medical context, and, you know, we just have to be reflective of, you know, take a pause and say, am I going down this rabbit hole and doing things based on reflex, and is this for the good of the patient? I think that's something of a strength in a physician, is being able to reflect and take that second to be like, am I operating in a biased way or not?
And so it seems like it's important then in the classroom to practice that reflection. And that's a lot of then what Rick would be doing, is asking people to learn that reflex. Like, I see that identifier, I'm not going to just accept it, I'm going to question.
Yeah, absolutely.
So building that muscle from day one in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which then has a trickle-down effect to patient care.
One of our biggest questions that we grapple with is, are we taking out too much? And a question that we get a lot is this just for political correctness? And it's a difficult question. But if we think about what the goal here is, again, it's for equity. And equity has to do with health. We see very clearly when there's inequity, there's worse health.
So thank you both for coming in today to talk to me about the process involved in BRIC as a means of debiasing our curriculum and helping our faculty to teach more equitably.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed this ClimbCast. Check out our other podcasts in CLIMB's Do No Harm series for help when teaching about social identifiers, for guidance on how to discuss health inequities using a critical lens, and for creating instructional materials and presentations about the impacts of the social determinants of health on health and access to quality health care.